Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What was life really like for the lost generation, artists, musicians, and writers? It is almost hard to fathom the creative richness of all those expatriates descending on Paris in the 1920s, luminaries like Léger, Picasso, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Archibald MacLeish, Robert Benchley, Cole Porter, and Dorothy Parker. They were not only brilliant individually, but they often came together socially to inspire and occasionally infuriate each other. Many of those gatherings were arranged and hosted by a remarkable couple of Americans who had left home with their three small children to escape the constricting lives expected of them by their socialite families. In Paris and in the south of France, Gerald and Sarah Murphy spent their money on comfortable homes, good art, and great parties. They nurtured their artist friends as both admiring consumers and as figures of an almost parental concern. And they had tremendous influence on the way the lost generation lived and worked. Author Amanda Vale tells their story in her 1998 book, now out in tradeback, called Everybody Was So Young, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, A Lost Generation Love Story. She's in town for a lecture tonight at 7 at the Dallas Museum of Art, which is hosting an ongoing exhibition of the art that the Murphys produced, inspired, and collected. Amanda, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
What made the Murphys so irresistible to the people around them?
I'm going to let one of their friends, whom you just mentioned, Archibald MacLeish, a poet, speak for me, if I can remember exactly or even close to what he said. He said there was a shine to life wherever they were, not a decorative added value, but a revelation of inherent loveliness, as if the thing was for an instant seen. And that's what they did. They made everything seem new and shiny to anybody that they talked to, that they were close to. They opened things up for everyone, including for themselves.
They had a genuine interest in the people that they knew. And it seems as though Sarah in particular was very charming and
oh,
warm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She had a great warmth and sort of extroverted magnetism. And Gerald was a little bit more introverted, but he had a very great sense of display, and he was good at kind of showing off for people. I mean, if you've read Tender is the Night, all that kind of show-offy stuff that Dick Diver does in the beginning of the book, that's Gerald to the life.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned this yet, but they were the inspiration for Nicole and Dick Diver, and the Murphys were not happy with Scott Fitzgerald after that book came out.
No, they weren't. And the one who was really unhappy was Sarah, not so much Gerald. Gerald was okay with it, I think. But Sarah, I think she felt that Fitzgerald came a little too close and revealed a little too much about things that were troubling in their lives and their relationship.
And there may have been things that he revealed sort of inadvertently that he hadn't realized were so close.
Absolutely. And I feel also he was writing metaphorically. So he made Dick into an alcoholic, and Gerald was never an alcoholic. What Gerald had and what Gerald's sort of breakdown secret, the thing that lay beneath his surface, was a struggle over his sexual identity. And, of course, this never comes up as a feature in Dick's life in Tender as the Night. But somehow the vulnerability that that Fitzgerald revealed in Dick is something that Sarah Murphy felt she did not want to have revealed about Gerald, I think.
Do you think that Sarah Murphy knew her husband was attracted to men?
Oh, yes, I do. And I feel this knowledge came to her over time, although I think Gerald was also quite candid with her early on. There's a letter that he wrote to her saying that basically she made him feel for the first time really like a man. And that this was one of the things that she gave to him. They had what seems to have been a very actually warm and intimate life. They had a sex life. They had three children. But his attractions were also elsewhere and more increasingly just that way.
And they both came from money, mm-hmm. but different kinds of families, and their families were not initially delighted to see them together.
No, and I think part of it may, quite honestly, now that I, almost in retrospect, I'm not sure I was even aware of this when I was writing the book, but I think part of the problem may have been that both families were sitting there thinking, I don't know what kind of marital material Gerald really is. But the other thing was that Sarah's family were just plutocratically wealthy. They were legendary. They had a lot of money. Her father was a real estate developer and a Printer's Ink magnate. He traveled the world. They had the girls. There were three sisters. Sarah had two sisters. And they had been presented to the King and Queen of England. They had sailed on the Kaiser's yacht. They had been dancing at the Viceregal Lodge in India. They really hobnobbed with crowned heads everywhere. And I think her father and mother both thought no one was good enough for their daughters, and certainly the son of a department store magnate, which is what Gerald's father was not good enough for her.
Yeah, and they worried that initially that he wouldn't be able to provide for Sarah.
That's absolutely true. And in the end, he only was able to do so because her father ended up settling money on all three of the daughters, and Gerald and Sarah took their share of the prospective inheritance and went off to live on it in England, in France.
So they went to live in France, and they had a sizable amount of money by today's standards, but they were not fantastically sort of Bill Gates rich.
No. Not even J.P. Morgan rich or whatever was, you know, the standard at that time. They were extremely comfortable, shall we say, but they never had multiple houses. You know, they had two houses. They had an apartment in Paris, which was not big, and they had this not very large villa in the south of France, which was, however, very gracious and charming, and which they made into an enchanted domain. And that was it. They didn't have anything else at the time.
One of the things that I think makes the book so fascinating is certainly there's this portrait of this couple, but you see all these figures that now in the late 20th and 21st century we see as larger than life. You know, people like Scott Fitzgerald and like Hemingway. And with those two in particular, you see them as these great figures, but you really see them as these two guys with problems. They're jealous of one another. They're kind of constantly both competing against each other and supporting each other in the same breath almost.
Well, I think that's part of the whole Gerald and Sarah mystique too, is that for them, these people were not famous people. They weren't names that they collected or wanted to know because they were famous or that they were achievers in some way. They wanted to know them because they were interesting, and they loved them because of what they were and what they did. And they were friends. And their entire relationship with all of this group of fantastically creative people was personal. It was about loving them as people.
They knew each other's kids. They sort of hung out all together.
Oh, there's wonderful portraits, actually, of Honoria Donnelly, Honoria Murphy, their daughter, in a little harlequin suit that was later used by Picasso for his son, Paolo, to pose in for a series of paintings that Picasso did. So you have this twinning of these two children. It's very, very touching. It's sweet.
We should say that the Murphys were really, not only did they give great parties where they had people over for dinner, but they were really into costumes and doing things in a really elaborate way.
Oh, absolutely. Well, there's a wonderful photograph, which I believe is in the exhibit, of Gerald Murphy in this extraordinary costume that he devised for himself for something called the Automotive Ball in Paris. And it's a costume that looks like something out of Picasso's ballet Parade. He's wearing this kind of conical hat, and he has a speaking tube welded to his shoulder, and he's Automotive Man is what it is. And he sort of looks like a car made into a person. It's just amazing. But they would do this sort of thing for their children too. They made these costume parties for them, and they would give them fantastic treasure hunts where they would get on a boat and sail for overnight to some place where they would say there was buried treasure, and then the children would dig and dig and dig, and they would find the box that the parents had planted weeks beforehand with all the fake jewelry in it and say, oh, look, you found pirates' booty. I mean, it's incredible what they did.
I love that story, and even they would describe it later as being, they remembered it as so great that they thought maybe it couldn't possibly have come out so well. And it did occur to me how wonderful all parents could be if they didn't have to work.
Oh, yeah. Well, and they worked, but they worked in a way that is the sort of the epitome of working at home. If you really wanted to do it, this is the way you should. And that they would get up in the morning, and Gerald would go to his studio, and he would paint, and the children would go and do their lessons, and Sarah would do household things. And then around noon, they'd all say, okay, we're done now. And they would go to the beach and sit around and drink sherry and nibble on little biscuits. And the kids would go in the water and they would hang out with their friends. And then they would come home and the children would have a nap. And then they would all get up and play together. And you just think, what bliss.
Gerald was, as you mentioned, a painter in his own right. And yeah. You see a lot of different influences. You see cubism and certainly there's a sort of a prescience about pop art. Legere was the one with whom he had a special bond.
Yeah, they met at some point in Paris. And I think Legere really taught Gerald a lot about how to fracture reality. He saw things in a way that Gerald found very striking. And a lot of that vision is picked up in some of Gerald's own work. But they would walk together along the Seine and look at barges, and you know, Léger would point things out to Gerald, or Gerald would point them out to Léger. And one of the things I found really, really interesting is Gerald kept a notebook in which he would write down the ideas that he had for paintings that he wanted to do. And then when he did them, he would check them off. There would be a little check mark next to them. There was one painting that he described that he never did check off, which was of a barge and a window of a barge, and how you would look through it and you would see a woman framed by the window in the barge. And I always thought, what a great painting that would make. And I was at the Léger Museum in the south of France, walking along, and there on the wall was that picture.
What a discovery.
But Léger painted it,
huh?
Not Gerald. And I'm thinking, how amazing. You know, he must have said, oh, look, you know, there's a great idea for a painting, and then Léger painted it. I love that.
And there are 7 of the paintings still in existence that anybody knows where they are. Some of those that have been lost are enormous canvases. Do you have any theories as to what happened to them?
Well, you know, the war intervened. Gerald and Sarah left Europe in 1929, actually a little bit later, because their youngest son, Patrick, had developed tuberculosis. And Gerald never painted again after his son was diagnosed. He gave up painting as if it was a kind of penance. If he did that, maybe his little boy would get well, he thought. And the paintings were rolled up, the ones that were not on view, and he didn't think about them. And then the war came, and who knew what would happen to them? They just disappeared. The biggest one, Bodek, which is this magnificent, huge, monumental painting. I can't even imagine what the dimensions are. I've forgotten them. But it was just monumental. It was the size of a James Rosenquist painting. And this was supposedly rolled up and stored at a painting warehouse. And it just disappeared. They have no record of it. Some people think maybe it was put up and rolled up on those roof of a barn somewhere. No one knows. It's disappeared. I keep hoping that, you know, now that people are beginning to find things that the Germans took away during World War II, they may find them in a salt mine someplace. I don't know.
Yeah, that would be exciting if it suddenly
were to
come about. You actually met them, Gerald
yes,
and Sarah,
did.
When you were just a little girl.
I did. My parents, my mother knew Honoria Murphy. She'd actually met her when my mother lived in France as a child, and she'd met Honoria in Cannes in the south of France. And many, many years later, they became friends again in New York. And so the Murphys always, always stayed in touch with their children's friends. They loved them, and they would cultivate a friendship with them. And so although Honoria was living in California at the time, Gerald and Sarah wanted to ask my mother and her husband and their little girl to tea one day, and they did.
We will get that story in just a moment, so you'll have time to tell the whole thing. We'll take a quick break. My guest is Amanda Vale. She's an author and critic. Her book is called Everybody Was So Young, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, A Lost Generation Love Story. She's in town to speak at the Dallas Museum of Art's Horchow Auditorium this evening at 7. You can find information about that at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Amanda Vail is my guest this hour. Her 1998 book, Everybody Was So Young, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, A Lost Generation Love Story, is also the subject of the lecture that she'll be giving tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art's Horchow Auditorium that takes place at 7. Of course, the Dallas Museum of Art is featuring an exhibition of the work that was inspired by, created by, and collected by the Murphys. You can see that, I believe, through September 4th. And if you'd like to join our conversation today, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Amanda, you were telling us about going to see the Murphys, and from what I understand, you weren't looking forward to going to hang out with your parents' elderly friends.
No, I was, 9 years old, and I thought, oh, God, they're going to be terrible old fuddy-duddies, and I'm not going to want to talk to them, so I'm going to take Chinese checkers with me. I don't know why I was so consumed with fascination with the Chinese checkers, because it's this great, big, enormous metal board with rattling marbles in it. But my folks were not terrible about it. They sort of let me do this. I guess they figured I would do it and then I would shut up. And I went over in the corner and I'm playing Chinese checkers by myself, with myself. And Gerald comes over and says, "Would you mind terribly?" And he had this wonderful sort of clear, crisp voice. "Would you mind terribly if I sat down with you and you could perhaps teach me how to play this fascinating game?" Well, I thought, my God, okay, I'll show him. So I showed him how to play Chinese checkers, which was, of course, adorable because Neil Zay, he knew how to do it.
Yeah.
But he let me pretend that I was doing this. And he let me, I don't remember whether he won or I won, but we played a game. And afterwards, Sarah gave tea to us all and asked me where her grandchildren should go to amuse themselves when they came to visit in a few weeks' time. And I remember being, I felt like a grown-up. I was very charming. I was absolutely transported. I became, I don't know, like the Vicomtesse de Noailles or something. I felt like somebody out of one of the Murphy's soirees. And I realized that they were doing to me what they did to everybody else, which was that they made me feel really, really special and as if I were as wonderful as they were.
Well, it stands to reason that they loved kids. They were good with kids. They had three of their own. But that's really was the source of the greatest sadness in their lives as well. You mentioned earlier that when he was nine, their youngest son, Patrick, was diagnosed in sort of a weird story with tuberculosis. Yeah. And they sort of realized the irony of realizing where he had caught it is pretty extraordinary. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Gerald had gone to work as a consultant on the first ever musical with sound called Hallelujah, which had a lot of Afro-American spirituals in it. And Gerald and Sarah had long loved African-American spirituals and used to sing them. And Gerald had even found them as in manuscript in library collections when no one was really interested in them. So he thought this was a great thing to do. And he was infuriated when, as often happens in Hollywood, the producers decided this authenticity was way too authentic and they should go for, much more popular type stuff. And they got Irving Berlin, I believe, to write something for them instead of using the authentic music that Gerald had found. But while they were there in Los Angeles, a chauffeur that they had who was very kind, very attentive to the children, carried the kids back from the hospital, from the car to the house when they came back from the hospital after having their tonsils out. They later found out that this young man had tuberculosis, and very likely that the kids at that time, with their immune systems lowered because they had had their tonsils out, may have caught the germ from him. And it was just heartbreaking to them to realize that this had happened.
So at that point, it doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter how much influence your family has. No. It's all about having a sick child. And their lives basically telescoped.
Yeah. And TB in those days was really like a death sentence.
There were no antibiotics.
There were no antibiotics. That's ironically the thing that killed both the Murphy's sons the things that killed them could have been averted if they had had antibiotics, because Patrick, the youngest, had TB, and if he'd had antibiotics, it would have been gone. As it was, they had a long battle with it, and finally in 1937, really 8 years after he was first diagnosed, he succumbed to it. They had taken him to Lake Placid, to Saranac Lake, to try to get a cure there. They tried Switzerland before that, and he'd have sort of remissions, but then he would get sick again. In the meantime, their healthy son, whose name was Beth, was away at school and got the measles, and then in the recovery period from that, he got a mastoid infection, and that turned into spinal meningitis, and he died in incredible agony in this course of a few days. And it was just dreadful.
And one of the things, again, that really strikes you during that is all their friends, these literary luminaries, come and visit the boys, not because the Murphys are important or anything, but these are kids they've known.
Oh, yeah.
And they wrote about it, and they, in some cases, illustrated sort of what was going on.
Oh, Leger painted or drew Patrick in his sickbed up in Saranac, and that beautiful drawing is in the exhibit at the Dallas Museum, along with a beautiful drawing of Leger by Patrick, which shows you what a talented little boy this was and what a loss, perhaps, to art that his death was. And Hemingway came and burst into tears when he left Patrick's room, and he was just sobbing, leaning up against a wall, saying, "He's so sick. He is so sick. My God, that boy is so sick. I can't stand seeing it."
Well, and it's very moving, because Hemingway in particular, you don't think of him as being a very tender figure. Despite what he would write, you imagine that he was always very sort of brash and cold.
Well, and he had very complicated relations with the Murphys. He said that he always felt about Gerald the way people who can't stand cats feel about cats. But he said he always loved Sarah, and that was true.
Loved her in maybe in a deeper way than just friends.
He had a kind of a, more than a crush, it was like a, he had a sort of erotic crush
like
on
an
her.
An infatuation.
And, you know, she had a sort of a tendre for him as well. She liked, weirdly, given that she was married to someone like Gerald, who was so fastidious and elegant and you know, not macho in any way, she had a thing for macho guys like her father. I think she always wanted to please them. I'm not sure of that. That's a little Freudian. But Hemingway was like that. And she really kind of got him, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Author Amanda Vail is here. Her 1998 book is available now in tradeback. It's called Everybody Was So Young, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, A Lost Generation Love Story. Let's go now to the phones and speak with Jerry in Denton. Hi, Jerry.
Well, hi. I think Gerald Murphy is just a fascinating person. And I realizing, of course, his relationship to the Dallas Museum of Art is wonderful. But I just wanted to relate, you know, when I was a young man and just going off to college and kind of very methodically reading myself through all of F. Scott Fitzgerald, the character of Dick Diver and the character of Scott Fitzgerald were very meaningful to me at age 18 or 19, a young kid coming from a public high school in the West to a snotty East Coast college, very much like Fitzgerald and Diver themselves. And this figure of Dick Diver, the early Dick Diver, who was so self-assured that I think that Fitzgerald described him as being the only American who could walk into any environment and any gathering and look at ease as though he belonged there. And that kind of image of this kind of magical young American was very meaningful to me as an 18-year-old, very much trying to adjust into the world of a snotty East Coast college.
Well, Jerry,
I just wanted to do that. And this is really a wonderful show.
Thanks so much for your call. I really appreciate your perspective on that, because that's another side, certainly, of Dick Diver and also of Gerald
And also
Murphy.
Of Gerald, who you wouldn't think this urbane man would have ever felt himself at ill at ease. But in fact, he often did amongst, you know, fraternity boys and stuff at Yale. He felt kind of nervous among them, and he developed this kind of preternatural assurance, I think, as an armor against exactly that kind of behavior.
Yeah, because we have lots of indications that he felt like a person who had many selves that no one else saw. There's a great photograph that's included in the book that he had taken of himself, which is sort of artistically done. I can't imagine that anyone thought of this without him asking for it. Can you describe that?
Well, it's a kind of a time-lapse, multiple-exposure photograph of himself in a beautifully tailored coat and hat, and he is sitting at a table, and it's as if he were reflected in a funhouse mirror a dozen times, so that you see 8 or 10 Geralds as if they're almost playing poker with one another. It's an extraordinary photograph, and it's sort of as if he were confronting all of his various selves.
And he would certainly, people who knew him well knew that he was uncomfortable in certain situations. And Sarah apparently said to him at one point, "It's like you don't want anyone to like you."
Yeah.
But he struggled with sort of revealing that dark side and not.
Oh yeah, totally. And said, in fact, right at the time when Sarah was saying, "It's like you don't want anyone to like you," he was about to travel back from Switzerland, where his son was in the sanatorium, to New York, and he was going to not see any of his friends. And the reason that he finally said he was trying to avoid them was that he felt if they really knew who I was, they wouldn't like me anymore.
Meaning, do you think that means if they really knew that he was gay, or if they really knew that he was...
That was largely it. And of course, he found himself almost unable to write candidly about this. He talks in this extraordinary letter, which is also in the collection on view at the exhibit. He talks about feeling conscious of a defect in himself from when he was a schoolboy, and that it is his consciousness of this that has made his relations with other people so difficult in his life.
Well, and I wonder, when he wrote in those veiled terms, everybody that he was writing to understood what he was talking about.
Yeah, they did. And, you know, people like Hemingway, the cat comment is only one of several. He also used to refer to those damn schoolgirl quarrels of Gerald's.
Over little things.
Over
that
little
suddenly...
things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he would characterize him in these slightly effeminate terms, Hemingway would. That was how he would, if he wanted to get at Gerald, he would say those things. I mean, everybody knew what was going on.
Well, and Hemingway was often in a position to need to take the money that Gerald and Sarah would offer him. At one point, his son needed medical care. They paid for that. They paid for their accommodations. But he would take this and then be doubly resentful of it at the same time.
That was an unfortunate part of Hemingway's character, I think, is that if he took from anyone, he then resented having to do so much that he took it out on them. I mean, he felt that way about Fitzgerald. The book that he wrote at the end of his life, A Movable Feast, is full of that kind of really excruciating portraits of people that had helped him. Fitzgerald, Gertrude Stein, Ford Madox Ford, all of them come in for it because they did something nice for him. And of course, the Murphys and John Dos Passos were right up there.
And toward the end of the time when the Murphys finally left Europe with their children, it seems like everything was falling apart. The entire lost generation was losing it.
This was so amazing. When I was writing the book, and I was at the point where I was going to write about them going to Switzerland because Patrick was sick. And I was looking to see, well, what had happened to everybody else at this point? And I realized that at this very moment, as they are traveling to Switzerland, Zelda Fitzgerald is being diagnosed with is crazy and is going into a mental asylum, also in Switzerland. The stock market is crashing. And Harry Crosby, with whom the Murphys used to share soirees occasionally in Paris, is shooting himself to death in New York City and killing himself and his mistress at the same time. It's as if the entire lost generation just decided, this is it, kids, and they're putting an end to it. It was just, it's devastating.
They had gay friends. Do you have any perspective on why it was okay for them to associate with people who were gay, but they just, that Gerald at least, couldn't sort of open up to.
Well, you know, homosexuality in America, particularly at that time, was, you just didn't talk about it. It didn't happen. It was really don't ask, don't tell. In Paris, it was a lot more out there. And you could have people like Étienne de Beaumont, who was this patron of the arts, who was a great friend of theirs, or Jean Cocteau, or whomever, who were living really openly as homosexuals. I mean, Étienne de Beaumont wasn't living openly as one. He had a wife, but everybody knew that that marriage was a marriage of convenience. And I just feel that one of the reasons that Paris was so appealing to the Perfis was that nobody cared. They just didn't, you know, the society did not care what your orientation was. They cared about what you did and whether you were charming and interesting and not whether you were gay or straight.
And Sarah and Gerald's marriage, to be clear, was not one of convenience. They were passionate about each other, regardless of what their sexual orientation might have been.
They fell madly in love with each other almost immediately, and I think it's because they were really soulmates. And each of them was a kind of an outcast. I mean, Sarah was someone who always felt a little bit like the square peg in her family's social circle. I mean, they were very focused on doing the right thing and being very social. And Sarah did not care for that stuff at all. She cared about books and music and art and social action. She had Mary McLeod Bethune, who was one of the early advocates for education, equal education for African Americans in this country, and who was herself a former slave. And she had Mary McLeod Bethune come to lunch at her family's house, which totally scandalized the Help and also her sisters, who were just could not believe what she was doing. But Mary McLeod Bethune was raising money for her cause, and Sarah thought she should be asked to lunch. So she asked her. And that's the kind of person she was. And she met Gerald, and Gerald was a man who cared about all the things that she did. And they just, they were soulmates instantly, and there was a definite physical attraction. As you read their letters, they're, you know, you feel as if you kind of tiptoed into a room and heard or seen things that you oughtn't to, and you kind of tiptoe away.
Yeah, they even have nicknames for each other.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We are talking with Amanda Vale. She's an author who's written a book called Everybody Was So Young, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, A Lost Generation Love Story. Of course, the art collection of Gerald and Sarah Murphy is on display, at least in part, at the Dallas Museum of Art right now. You can go see that. You can also hear Amanda speak tonight at 7. You can find information about that at dallasmuseumofart.org. If you want to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send your email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Amanda Vale. Her book is called Everybody Was So Young, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, A Lost Generation Love Story. You can go to see her speak tonight at 7 at the Dallas Museum of Art in the Horchow Auditorium. This is all part of the ongoing exhibit of works collected by and created by Gerald and Sarah Murphy. You can join our conversation this afternoon by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Well, Amanda, our caller earlier referred to this, but there's a really close connection, not just because of this exhibition, but between Gerald and Sarah Murphy and the DMA.
There absolutely is. And I really believe that the DMA restored to Gerald the sense of himself as an artist. He had, as we were talking about earlier, in 1929, when his son Patrick was diagnosed with TB, he gave up painting. He rolled up his canvases. He put away his brushes. He never thought about or spoke about painting again. And people didn't talk about it with him. It was like the thing you didn't mention because, you know, too much painful associations. And then in the early 60s, this amazing exhibit of American artists appeared at the DMA, or actually its forerunner, the Museum of Contemporary Art. And all of a sudden, Gerald was a person of interest. And he apparently, when they called him about this to ask him if it would be possible to borrow two of his paintings to exhibit in the show, he came back and he said to his family, "I've been discovered. What does one wear?"
So he actually came down, right,
and
for the exhibition?
He came here. He was so overcome by the reception that when it came time to close up the exhibit and send everything home, he said to Dallas, "Well, you can keep the paintings because I'm so grateful to you for having done this. I want to give them to you." So he made a gift of these two extraordinary paintings, Watch and Razor, which are here. He gave them to the DMA.
And this was 4 years before he died. Is there any evidence whatsoever that he thought about taking up painting again?
He said that it was too late by then. He thought about it for a little bit. He kept thinking, oh, maybe I could. And then he just very, very sadly concluded he couldn't.
One of the things that breaks your heart, and there's, I suppose, more that Gerald had written that is in this vein than Sarah ever did, but he says that the only parts of his life that ever meant anything were the ones that were created.
Yeah.
And I'm paraphrasing horribly, but boy, that really, it breaks your heart.
Yeah, he said, to Scott Fitzgerald, actually, "I know now that what I said to you is true, that only the invented part of our life has had any real beauty." And that's just heartbreaking. But it is also that it's, in a weird sort of a way, it's a testament to what they did, that they were able to create something of such beauty, that it really meant something to him. And it was that the act of creating was the most important thing for him. It was nothing to him to just be, you know. So in a funny way, it was maybe a kind of positive thing as well.
So that's an interesting way to look at it. You can sort of cobble together a beautiful life even out of other things if you make the conscious effort. Their relationship stayed strong even after they lost their sons, and they were back. He had to work then at Mark Cross, which was his father's company, which was about to go under.
Yes, it was. Mark Cross was, alas, it doesn't exist any longer, but it was kind of the Ralph Lauren of its day. It was a lifestyle company, and it purveyed luxury goods to Americans who had made a lot of money. And it was the kind of place where you went to buy the things that would make you feel as if you'd actually had your money for more generations than you had.
Something that Gerald's family could relate to.
Absolutely true. They knew what they were doing. So, you know, they had the gorgeous cocktail shakers and the beautiful leather goods and the this and the that. And Gerald, who had, you know, an incredible eye for things, became actually a genius merchandiser. And was able to find extraordinary stuff for Mark Cross when he took it over. His father had never actually let him work there when he was a young man. He disparaged him. His father was not a very comfortable paternal figure. But when his father died and the company was about to go under and Gerald took it over, he suddenly revealed this genius for retailing. Very ironic.
Yeah, it's funny though. You imagine if they had to work together, that it would have been even more miserable because, you know, his father wasn't very appreciative. There's a story in there about him being 10 years old and falling into a pond when they're out on a walk, and his father says, "You can just walk the rest of the way."
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's the kind of guy he was. He also came to his father with this idea that it would be such a great thing, instead of using straight edge razors, he'd heard that, you know, someone had been monkeying around with a safety razor that would be something that would you could put into your shaving kit and take with you, and you wouldn't cut yourself with it because it would have this little metal housing. And he said, "You know, I think this is a really great thing. We should get behind this." And his father said, "Are you crazy? What are you thinking of?" And so, of course, King Gillette beat them to the punch with it and became a very wealthy man. And Mr. Murphy, I guess, never really ate his words. But the razor is on view in the painting that's in the Dallas Museum. So Gerald kind of got a little bit of his own back there.
Yeah, there's a razor and a box, a book of matches, yeah. and I forget what the
and
other
a pen,
objects are.
A pen, a fountain pen.
Mm-hmm. So it's all, you can sort of read into all of that.
Mm-hmm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can send email to think@kera.org. I'm curious as to whether You think there was something about the 20s, whether there was something about Paris. I mean, there was obviously something special about Gerald and Sarah, but what I'm not aware of that sort of collection of brilliant people existing today or at any other time in quite the same way.
It was a magical moment. And part of it had to do with, I think, the cataclysm of World War I, which had eliminated almost an entire generation of young men. And in a really horrible sort of way, it created a clean canvas. It made people think things went so horribly wrong with this war, we need to do things differently in every way, not just in political terms, but in social and indeed in artistic terms. And so there was an extreme upwelling of invention everywhere. And particularly in Paris, you look at all of the people who came there, there's, you know, there are many, many émigrés from other countries. James Joyce and Samuel Beckett, there's Fitzgerald, there's Hemingway, there's Man Ray, there's Tristan Tzara, who founds the Dada movement. You know, there are all these extraordinary people. And then in France itself, you've got, you know, Cocteau, and you have Erik Satie making beautiful music, and you've got the Russians like Stravinsky, and it's all just cooking there. I mean, can you imagine what a cross-fertilizing moment?
We have already talked a little bit about Fitzgerald's works, but I'm wondering if you'll talk about some of the other books that the Murphys sort of appear in or almost appeared in, or people may want to go back and reapproach these works with an eye toward who Sarah and Gerald were.
Well, I sort of find them lurking about in various places. One of them, which was a real surprise to me, actually, was that in The Sun Also Rises, which Hemingway read in manuscript form to Gerald and Sarah, they were sitting up on their sofa and he read the whole thing to them and they were completely blown away by it. The character of Robert Cohn in that, who is kind of the rich patsy that everybody takes advantage of, in an early manuscript draft, I guess not the one he read to Gerald and Sarah.
We have to hope not.
Cohn is referred to as Gerald Cohn. And you do wonder whether the man who felt about Gerald the way people who don't like cats feel about cats was kind of having a little dig at him there. Hemingway also, I think, used Sarah in The Snows of Kilimanjaro. He talks about the heroine having a well-known, well-loved face from Town, the pages of Town and Country, or the cover of Town and Country. And Sarah's engagement photograph had appeared on the cover of Town and Country, which Hemingway well knew because he'd written to tell her that when he was hiking in the West, he found that magazine cover tacked up on the wall of a mountain man's hut somewhere in Idaho. So, you know, there are all those things. There's also, obviously, in Tender is the Night, Gerald and Sarah appear as models. And Archibald MacLeish wrote poems about Sarah. He wrote an ode to her. But he also used Gerald and Sarah and their trials and tribulations in his Pulitzer Prize-winning verse play, J.B., which was about a Job figure who has dreadful things happen to him, including the loss of his children.
And there are – Picasso did a couple of portraits as
oh,
well.
Oh, yes. Right? Of course he did. And Picasso had a great fascination for Sarah. He thought she was très festin, he said, which is not even a French word. It's something he made up, I think. sort of – it's not Spanglish. It's Spranglais. At any rate. But he loved her, and he painted her in clothes, but he also painted or drew a number of nudes that look very like Sarah and have, as she always used to have, long necklaces of pearls, which she used to wear to the beach. And it leads you to think that he was at least, if there was no actual smoke and fire there, that at least this is what he was thinking about, what she would look like if she wasn't wearing any clothes.
It's funny to think of how that speaks to her and to the era, wearing a pearl necklace to the beach.
Oh, well, that was – she used to say that it was the sun was good for the pearls, so that's why she did it. And actually, it is good for – and the warmth. Warmth is very good for pearls.
Do you think that they – I mean, obviously, they saw themselves in all these things. They were able to recognize it. And yet they forgave their friends for these things and never sort of divorced themselves completely from these people who did things that might have been hurtful. What explains that?
That's a very interesting question. They were mad at Fitzgerald, you know, for a little while about, or Sarah was, about Tender as the Night. But they always forgave because I think they had huge hearts. They loved their friends too much to ever really be cross at them for too long. I mean, again, when Fitzgerald would transgress by throwing Sarah's beautiful Venetian wine goblets over the wall at Villa America when he was drunk, you know, Sarah said, "No, Scott, you must go away and you may not come back for 2 weeks." But after 2 weeks, he was allowed to come back and everything was fine and she still loved him. So, you know, it's they were very forgiving people of each other as well as of their friends.
It's interesting about Sarah because she's described in sort of the literature of the time and by people since then as this great beauty of her era. You look at the pictures now and she's lovely, but it clearly had to be her spark that made her this notable beauty that no one could resist.
Well, you know, the other thing that's interesting is that by the time she's really being photographed in the 20s, she was older. She was, you know, easily 10 years older than most of their friends. And so Sarah's 40, you know, which in 1925
pre-Botox,
is, you know, pretty, absolutely. This is not, you know, she was no spring chicken. And she'd had 3 children and she tended to gain and lose weight in kind of interesting ways. When I was doing my book, there would be the fat pictures of Sarah and then there would be the skinny pictures of Sarah. And they kind of depended. They would come
and go. I liked her for that.
You know, absolutely. I could totally relate. Let me tell you. I mean, there's a picture of her in jeans out at the Hemingway's Ranch in Wyoming. You want to kill her. She's got this tiniest butt. And I hated her when I saw that picture. And then there's a picture of her on her yacht, the Weatherbird, and she's clearly been, you know, hitting the French bread or something. And there's a fair amount of billowing, curvaceous flesh there. And you're thinking, okay, honey, it's all right. But she had this extraordinary magnetism. And you really hear it in her voice. I had tapes of her talking and you'd hear she had this kind of drawl. And she just, you know, she'd talk kind of like that. And you just hear that voice and you think, oh, my Lord, what a woman.
She outlived her husband by 11 years. Can you talk about what she said on her deathbed?
Oh, on her deathbed, she was humming, "Here Comes the Bride." And her daughter said to me, "Well, I know why she was doing that. She was going to Gerald." That's very, and by then she'd been suffering from dementia. She was very, you know, she'd forgotten virtually everything by the time she died, but she hadn't forgotten that.
But she was waiting to be with him again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And their daughter, I guess, was the one that your mother was close to.
Yeah.
And preserved her parents' legacy pretty carefully.
Extraordinary. She had virtually, first of all, the Murphys did not throw things away. I don't understand how they could have lost those paintings because they didn't lose tablecloths. They didn't lose glassware. All of that stuff was in her house in East Hampton, and I would go out and stay with her and look at it. It was amazing.
Must have been great times. Mm-hmm. Amanda Vail's book is called Everybody Was So Young, Gerald and Sarah Murphy, A Lost Generation Love Story. You can see her lecture at the DMA tonight at 7. That takes place in the Horchow Auditorium. You can find information at Dallas Museum of Art.org. Amanda, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been wonderful. Thanks you very much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.